Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here this week with Russell Chianelli, our co-host from time to time. And today we've got a guest from the University of Kentucky. Her name is Amelia Galperin. She's a professor in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology, Biochemistry. And welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Welcome, Amelia, to Science Studio. How did you get into science?
I think in the first place this was just a curiosity. I thought that, you know, the nature created something very interesting and it's all changing and it's all different. So, and the textbook was written very well, so I kind of liked biology in the first place.
Well, don't you have memories that go back? Some of the people that we talk to say, well, when I was a little kid, I saw this thing crawling under the stone and I became curious in life and organisms and...
Well, unfortunately, I don't like things that crawl. So I think the impact was, in fact, the teachers, not the nature itself, but rather the teachers, the way they presented things to us, the way. My first affinity was to chemistry, rather to biology as a school kid. But then it sort of switched a little bit more to biology due to all sorts of circumstances. And molecular biology, in fact, was thanks to the professor I got in Israel, that she was very passionate about what she was telling. And less of the science, more of the stories around the science, how important the story science can be to the day-to-day life. And that what sort of got me into, oh, yeah, I want to continue this. In particular, I want to be a molecular biologist, not just any kind of biologist.
Let's just sort of go into that a little further. You said you studied in Israel, but before Israel... You came from Russia, Soviet Union then, I guess, in those days. Tell us a little bit about how that education in the Soviet Union really sort of began to guide you into areas. Tell us how that prepared you for what was to come later in Israel and now in the U.S.
You know, school in Russia was this sort of whole experience. You don't necessarily have a choice and go toward science versus toward languages. So this whole idea that you can be exposed to everything, and my parents told me you should do well in school, so I did well in school in every possible, you know, subject. And I think biology and chemistry was what the most interesting. And again, I think it was because of the teacher, thanks to the teacher, that this was presented in a way I liked it. And perhaps my kind of affinity to biology, that's what always I thought biology is, this is the science for me, not something else. And I never wanted to be a doctor, or I never wanted to be a lawyer, or I guess I didn't like mathematics too much. So biology and chemistry seems to be the subject for me. And I suppose we've been exposed enough to biology and chemistry and all other disciplines. So I had a choice. And, you know, I sort of made a choice, not a choice made it for me. But
so that was a choice that you made before you immigrated to Israel? Or
pretty much, yeah, right. Pretty much.
What year did you immigrate?
1990.
So that was after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
That's when we could move out, after the collapse of Soviet Union. So as soon as they opened borders, my parents submitted paperwork and started packing. So we waited for a year until they let us out, and we were out.
And when you got to Israel, I mean, you were telling me earlier before this program that there were certain tests that you were given to see where your aptitudes were. Tell the audience about this.
Well, Israel has a different system, a little bit different than here. We have to take a series of tests before we get to the university, and depend on the score, how high score is, we can be admitted to certain programs. So being a new immigrant and knowing very little about those tests, I did only very little preparation. So my test scores were not terrific. I couldn't be admitted to medical program or to law school or things like that. But I was good enough, and I wanted to go to biology. I was good enough to go to biology. But I think what helped really is that at that time there were many kids like me who came with and wanted to go to university, had very little knowledge of Hebrew, and government decided for 2 years they had this program for the new immigrants when they grouped us in classes and let us sort of get prepared for university. It was a part of the university education, but the first 6 months were dedicated to get us up to speed with anybody else before we enter the class, the general class. So, and Tel Aviv University had this program out of, I think, two other universities. And I was very fortunate to get into this program. They accepted me, and that's how I met my future PhD advisor, and that's what got me into molecular genetics and molecular biology. It's just sometimes destiny, serendipitous events that take you places, and that's how it all sort of came together.
So your PhD advisor was a woman? Could you tell us her name and a little bit about, you know, what she did to the students that made them excited?
Her name is Mia Horovitz. She's still a professor at University of Tel Aviv. She studies genetic diseases, and the particular one is a Gaucher disease, which is an enzymatic disorder, and Ashkenazi Jews has a lot of mutations, and due to that sort of thing, she studied this particular disorder. But her role in this class for new immigrants was to get us up to speed with molecular biology, because in Russia, this particular aspect of science was not very well established at all, when we didn't have enough background to get into those classes, because Russia has a lot of chemists and a lot of zoologists and a lot of botany. But molecular biology and genetics, as you know, was a prohibited science for very long. So because she was a geneticist, she gave us this introductory class. And her stories and enthusiasm and I guess, personality, and this was a starting point. And I'm sure not all of us right away went to, there were about 20-something of us went to the genetics, but I don't know, there was something about her, about the stories, that I thought that's the place. And I went and I asked if she can take me for the 6 months project, and she took me. And that's how it all started.
You just mentioned something, and some of the audience will know this, and many, many won't. You mentioned that genetics wasn't sort of a subject that would be studied. It was sort of frowned upon.
Yeah.
Could you go through a little bit of the history just for a few minutes? Because a lot of the audience won't know this.
It's an interesting, because my mother, for instance, which is a generation before me, right, she never even studied, because it was a prohibited science. Because of the Lysenko science, that everything should be nurtured, and there's no such a genetics. We can nurture certain functions and make them, make them better. So she was involved, for instance, in growing corn. And there was this famous phrase of his about the corn and growing tomatoes. So no genetics existed. And when I went to school, it existed in small portions, but not to the level it should have been taught in the United States or in Israel at that time. So it was just, in a rudimentary stage there, and nobody ever really paid attention to genes and genetics. And, Mendel was probably as far as we went in terms of genetics in school. So we had to have these classes in Israel just
and
to bring us.
And the concept there was that the Soviet system would provide environments for people to flourish.
Exactly.
And not only flourish, but flourish where the system wanted you to flourish.
Yeah, right? Exactly. The system wanted you to flourish. So it was different. And I can't tell specifically why genetics, why not something else, because some friends of mine from the same program went and studied mosquitoes. But it was something about this. Today, I think mostly the stories Mia told us around the, how marriages are based on the genetic background and stuff like that in the Jewish community and stuff like that. So I think there was something in her stories and enthusiasm.
The genetics now is just raging. I was reading an article this morning about how people are arguing about you can actually modify children at birth genetically so they're immune to some disease or something as they grow up.
Well, I think we're a little bit far from that. Yeah, it's a concept. It may be an idea of somebody. I don't think it's that simple, and I don't think it's easily done nowadays.
Yeah, maybe not easily done, but it's coming. Would you support that?
Not necessarily. I also don't support genetic profiling for everything. I don't think there is necessarily a need for profiling at birth and knowing what other genes you have there. So.
Well, let's get right on to that, because you're an expert on something called Noonan's disease or Noonan syndrome. What is it actually? Is it a disease or a syndrome, and what's the difference?
Noonan is a disease. I wouldn't call myself an expert to begin with, but I know a little bit about that.
Around this table, you are.
But Noonan is a disease, and it's part of the syndrome that cumulatively called rhizopathies. And cumulative called rhizopathies because about 15 years ago, people finally understood what are the genes responsible for those diseases. They all, patients with those diseases, they look similar. They have the particular phenotypic face expression, let's put it this. They're a little bit short. They have they're a little bit slow in development. A lot of them predisposed to cardiac hypertrophy, and some of them predisposed to cancers. But all of this is because of the mutations in certain molecular pathway, and it happens to be pathway that I study. But that's why they all call rhizopathies. But Noonan itself is, I suppose, the most famous out of these rhizopathy diseases because it was the first one to characterize. It was characterized by a young pediatrician. At that time, she was at University of Iowa, and she singled out a group of pediatric patients that they had heart problems, and they all looked very similar. And
visually,
yeah, they have this particular facial expression that you can't mistaken for anything else.
What other symptoms are there besides the facial expression? Able to speak well?
No, they speak well. They develop some neurocognitive problems. They have a very short stature. They have this webbed neck over here.
Oh, yeah.
And so the first patients with what we know today is Noonan patient was described probably in 1800s, but people didn't know that it's a part of this Noonan syndrome. But they have all sorts of other things going on for them. And some of them, in fact, outgrow, depending on a mutation, and they can lead a fairly normal life. But some of them have severe difficulties, and some of their mutations can cause early death and even in death in infancy. So there is a big variability within rhizopathy patients.
But so if it's a genetic disease or genetic predisposition, it clearly runs in families.
Yeah, it's a germline mutation that it's a familial disease.
Right.
So there are families with those kids. And you need only one parent to get it.
So what's your interest in this disease professionally, as a cell biologist?
I happen to study a protein that is what I consider a newest member of the rhizopathy patients, rhizopathy proteins. When I started studying this, it was a pure scientific peculiarity in terms of scientific questions. But as I get along, the first paper was published saying that there are a group of patients that have mutation in this protein. They look a little bit different from Noonan, because they have this problem with hair. So sometimes it's called Noonan with anagen hair disease. But otherwise, they look very similar. But so this sort of I guess serendipity that brought me from the pure scientific question, a peculiarity, curiosity, I guess, to disease itself.
Serendipity crops up so many times in Science Studio, and it turns out serendipitously it's time for a break. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Amelia Galperin from the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry at the University of Kentucky. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. With marijuana use legal in 20 states and counting, it's possible more Americans become users and some addicted. If so, what's the health impact, especially for kids?
One study ranked marijuana number 8 for its harmfulness to the user and society. Alcohol, heroin, and crack cocaine took the top 3 spots. But some argue when marijuana use is as common as alcohol and tobacco, it would be just as harmful.
We know the occasional user bears little risk, and short-term use hurts short-term memory, making learning difficult. Their motor function is also impaired, so driving and doing certain jobs are risky.
At very high doses, marijuana can cause psychoses, and long-term use can lead to addiction. Of people who smoke it daily, a quarter to half become addicted, while just 17% of adolescents do.
However, teen brains are highly vulnerable since they are not fully developed. Studies show kids who smoke pot regularly have cognitive impairment and lower IQs.
From lab animals, we've learned the active ingredient in marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol, disrupts the ability of neurons to make connections. Teens who are heavy users also have a smaller hippocampus, which inhibits memory and learning.
Their prefrontal activity affecting cognitive control is also lowered, so they don't plan and problem solve as well. One effect is higher school dropout rates.
Questions still remain about marijuana's connection to deadly disease, its second and third-hand smoke, and its impact on pregnant women. It is clear that young people should be wary about this seemingly innocuous drug.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, and Emilia Galperin from the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry, University of Kentucky. We were talking about this particular disease, Noonan disease, and how it's a genetic disease and how you got into it, in a sense, by accident, because you were looking at different pathways associated with different proteins.
That's
and
good.
Then all of a sudden, it connected you to Noonan's disease.
Yep.
So now you've made the connection. And in America, if you've got a disease to study, it's easier to get funding. So, whoosh, what did you do?
Well, by the time I realized that there is a mutation and there is a connection, I was already at University of Kentucky. The first thing I hear when I came that Jackie Noonan now works in UK, and she actually
You mean the United Kingdom?
No, I mean in University
of
Kentucky.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Oh, dear. Oh,
she
how disappointing.
It was very exciting. So I say, yeah, that's probably we should continue. And so with the Noonan syndrome and start trying to figure out what is the function of this particular protein in development. So one of the directions that I took because of the developmental relation of protein I study and the to the Noonan syndrome, I went to an initiated collaboration with the Professor Ann Morris in the Department of Biology. And I have a project that we study. We're using zebrafish to understand the function of SHOC2 in development.
Now, hold on a minute. You've got a disease, Noonan's disease, and all of a sudden we're talking about zebrafish. Just tell the audience how there's such an obvious connectivity. Is it just that, well, you tell us, where's the connectivity?
Zebrafish have been used as a model to study development for years. It's a very good developmental model. It's easy to handle. You can get a lot of – it's easy to manipulate. All the embryos are transparent. We can observe development from very early time points, from pretty much 2 hours and several days, and we can generate models that glow in dark and things like that. So it was very beneficial to we really do not understand what this protein is doing. We know a definition of what it's doing, but how it functions, what particular signals, why do we get Noonan syndrome when mutation happens in this protein? We really don't understand this. So I thought that zebrafish as a developmental model would be...
But how do you get the protein into the zebrafish is really the question.
The protein is very well conserved, and zebrafish has this protein which is 82% identical to the human counterpart. So this wasn't a big problem for us to get a protein. Protein is there, and the function is conserved. So we just decided, okay, let's go back a little bit and see what the protein doing in the zebrafish. And by understanding what's the protein doing in zebrafish, we probably will have a good idea of what exactly this protein doing in humans.
How do you determine from a zebrafish what the protein is doing?
There is a method that called Marfalina. There are small synthetic oligos that we can inject into the egg of the zebrafish, and we can follow, again, development of a zebrafish pretty much from the point zero all along and see what happens with the embryonic development, what is missing in those embryos that we have injected with Marfalina.
Okay, so you inject this substance, Marfalina, and then you see the effects on the eggs?
We see effects on the embryo development.
Yeah.
We see whether there is a head, whether there is a tail, where we can follow the blood vessel development, we can follow the blood cell development, how many cells are there, whether they're actually present or missing, what happens with the brain, what happens with the eye development. Everything can be followed using a simple microscopy up to 4 days, and we can follow this every 2, 4, 12 hours time period, and it was very informative for us.
Do some of the students just say, oh, I don't think this is the sort of research I want to be involved in? You know, I mean, when you're actually creating embryos, as you just said, with no head, maybe some with two heads or some with two tails. To a lot of people, they think, oh, come on, there's got to be a better way to forward research and understanding than that. Is that an argument that you hear very often?
No, it's really not an argument I hear at all, because we try to, well, for the one reason, it's a very informative model. It's visually very attractive model. The other hand,
attractive in the sense you're getting good information
yes,
from it,
exactly.
But not attractive to actually conceive
well,
and think about.
Well, they're actually
at.
Very pretty. I find
well,
it
you
very
know,
pretty.
It's a comment on that. I know a student that did the zebra test, just what you're talking about for something else. And she was saying that after cutting off 10,000 heads of zebrafish, she kind of got tired.
Well, I can see that. 10,000 zebrafish heads, it's a lot of heads.
How big is a zebrafish? An inch?
Probably slightly bigger than an inch. Maybe slightly bigger than an inch. Okay. Maybe 3 centimeters,
right.
4 centimeters.
Well, anyway, from all of this useful research, what have you begun to find?
Well, before I get to what we begin to find, we have another side of the project when we're looking into molecular changes and we're using our knowledge of molecular biology and biochemistry. So the idea behind zebrafish was how do we connect what we know using hardcore biochemistry and molecular biology with the developmental defects that we obtain. So this is primarily goal for our research. What we found so far is that the protein we study is involved in hematopoiesis, which is blood cell differentiation. So when we deplete our protein from zebrafish embryo, we lose blood cells and the zebrafish become anemic. So right now we're in the process of understanding what molecular processes are defective, what leads on a molecular level to this changes in blood cell differentiation and anemic embryo.
So let's now go back one step. Blood cell differentiation. The implication to me is that blood cells in different parts of the bodies are different, right? So a blood cell, and correct me when I go wrong, because I'm sure I will, a blood cell in my toe, for example, is different from a blood cell anywhere. I don't get it.
I don't think so. Blood cell in the toe is the same.
Right.
What I'm talking
so
about
blood
is
cell differentiation.
Differentiation.
Then?
We have in development there is one progenitor blood cell, so it's a sort of precursor for every blood cells that we have today, and then it differentiates to red blood cell erythrocytes, and then we can get neutrophils, we can get leukocytes, we can get lymphocytes. So all of these come from one progenitor cell, and somewhere along the way, when this stem cell or this progenitor blood cells become something else, signal is amiss from the protein that we study, and that's what causes the defects. And that's what we're trying to understand on a molecular level. Where is the defect? And by understanding the defect, we can understand how the Noonan syndrome really developed. What's going on there? Why do we get a Noonan child from this missing signal somewhere along the way? Where is this happening?
Is the structure of that protein understood? Because, you know, here we have models and all kinds of things like that.
We have a model, but we do not have a real structure. We're working on that. We're actually trying to get a real structure. But we have a pretty good idea because the protein itself, similar to other protein in terms of a secondary structure, that proteins that have been crystallized, we know structure for them. So we think that the protein is shaped as a banana or a horseshoe.
Yeah. Yeah. So do we know how the protein is affected to create some of these changes that you see?
Yeah, we know mutation. We know where
so
mutation.
So the mutation in the protein is the thing that causes different cells to
correct. Yeah.
Anemia and so on and so
no,
forth.
No. These are two different subjects. We know mutation that causes Noonan. The reason for the anemia is the lack of the protein entirely. When protein in lack, signals of the signaling pathways are not transmitted correctly. And when signals are not transmitted correctly, and I mean by correctly, it can be anything from the signal amplitude or from the signal duration, then we have a disease.
Okay, so this particular protein is responsible for creating the cells in the right way or the wrong way.
This particular protein is responsible for transmitting signals in the right way, with right amplitude and right duration.
Well, what do you mean by the right amplitude? I mean, people know amplitude, you know, how loud is my voice, how soft is my voice.
That's pretty much it.
Well, but I mean, the proteins aren't yelling at each other.
Yeah, they say, make that cell, not that one.
Right. I mean, what does that mean to a cell biologist, the amplitude of the signal?
The amplitude of the signal, it's how much of the signal we have at the, any given moment.
And the signal is a well, what is a signal?
Well, in my term, signal is a postnatal modification of the protein and activation of the substrate. Signal means that something gets phosphorylated and it starts doing its function.
So it's the initiation of a chemical transformation.
Yeah.
Right. And then, so it's the efficiency of that chemical transformation that we're talking about.
Yep.
So now a signal becomes much more interesting to Russell and myself here, right?
Yeah, so the information needs to be transduced or transmitted. And if we have too much information, there would be a complete disorder. We only need as much of this information for processes in development to go right way. Because even increase in even twofold increase can be catastrophic in development. The same for the duration of the signal. It should be timed very precisely.
Noonan's disease is a genetic disease, mm-hmm. and there's lots of genetic diseases out there. Do you see in the future a time when there won't be genetic diseases because we've become so sophisticated and clever that at birth we can do something and whoops, that genetic predisposition or that genetic imperfection, I'll call it an imperfection because that's rather arrogant, but doesn't exist anymore?
I don't think so.
If you don't see a time that we can be rid of genetic diseases, what are we trying to do? We're trying to let the people who have the disease live a little bit longer through different medications. You know, I mean, it's an interesting intellectual conundrum that I'm seeing here. You know, we see a disease, we understand it, but we're not going to be able to treat it unless we can change the genome of that particular patient. So what are we really trying to do,
apart from understanding, I think that treating disease, it's in fact the future for now. And there are other examples when patients that get treatment or they get sort of what they're missing with the medication doing very well in life. So
I think there's another way to answer that question. How much more do you have to do with this protein to really understand it? Is this research coming to an end, or do you understand it?
By all means, no. I think it's just a beginning, which makes it very exciting that we understand very little of what I'm actually dealing with. I think there is much more to that. Understanding of this particular protein, I think, will be beneficial not only for the patients with Noonan syndrome, but also for understanding all sorts of cancerous processes. Because this particular pathway that we study is very often deregulated in a variety of cancers. In fact, 30% of cancers have this pathway deregulated. So understanding how molecules contribute to the cancer deregulation, cancer progression, sorry, and how they work in general will be beneficial not only for the small population of people that have Noonan syndrome or Noonan-like syndrome, but also for the much larger population of people that have this MAP kinase pathway deregulated and, you know, they have cancer.
Well, you know, this is a never-ending search, as you point out. I mean, you know little, then you know a lot, and then you suddenly realize you know little. I mean, we go in that sort of cycle in science. But it's very fascinating. Emilio Galperin from the Department of Molecular Cell Biochemistry at the University of Kentucky. It's been a pleasure having you here on Science Studio. Liked very much what we've learned, and thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you very much. Please come back, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you
and
very much.
And above all, thank you being out there and listening, because, you know, Norma's here, Russell's here, Keith's here, Amelia's here, but if there's no one out there, that doesn't mean much, does it? See you next week. Bye-bye.
I can hear the cheering.